Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. To some people, graffiti is vandalism. To others, it's much more positive than that. We'll explain a little bit later. Positive is not a word that necessarily comes to mind in today's politics. Much of the rhetoric is negative, and that's how it's being received by much of the electorate. Voters are in a restive mood, showing signs of anger, anxiety, and frustration. Candidates of all parties are trying to tap into and feed these emotions. This week, NPR, along with some member stations, are analyzing the national mood of voters. We'll be looking into it locally on today's program. What's your mood? The NPR project was launched on Morning Edition with national political correspondent Mara Liasson.
You can't talk to voters this year without hearing some pretty powerful emotions, and all the candidates are trying to show they get it. For Republicans like Marco Rubio, it's President Obama's fault.
And a president that on 10 occasions around the world has apologized for America. Apologized. And this is why people are so frustrated. This is why they're so angry. That's why this election's played out so differently.
On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders' angry tirades have found a receptive audience.
This campaign is sending a message to the billionaire class. Yes, we have the guts to take you on.
Hillary Clinton has talked herself hoarse, explaining that she takes seriously the fears and insecurities of ordinary voters.
They're worried that they're going to be left behind while the people on the top, the guys who always get ahead, keep taking, leaving very little for anybody else. There's a lot of worry.
And no one has identified with or stoked voters' anger better than Donald Trump.
I will gladly accept the mantle of anger. Our military is a disaster. Our health care is a horror show. Obamacare, we're going to repeal it and replace it. We have no borders. Our vets are being treated horribly. Illegal immigration is beyond belief.
There are lots of good reasons voters are so ticked off this year. Number one, says former White House aide Bill Galston, is the absence of the kind of broadly shared economic growth that makes the American dream possible.
When you consider the fact that household incomes are still thousands of dollars below where they were at the end of the Clinton administration, people have gone a long time without making a lot of progress, and they know it. They're feeling it, and they're not very happy about it.
Another big factor is terrorism. Whether or not you think ISIS poses an existential threat to the United States, after San Bernardino, there was no question that the war on terror has come back home, and that's scary. Then there's demographic change, says Harvard political scientist Daniel Allen, who points out that 2014 was the first year the majority of American kindergartners were minorities.
So we're only a dozen years away from majority-minority voting cohorts entering into our voting ranks. So in other words, in some parts of the country in particular, there's just a sort of incredibly durable tradition of white political and social control. And that demographic transition is forcing to a head the question of what happens now.
This is why immigration has become such a flashpoint, particularly in the Republican primaries. Professor Roberto Serro is an immigration expert at the University of Southern California.
One of the most illustrative things that has happened this year was in the way that Donald Trump switched from Mexicans to Muslims almost instantaneously.
It was a simple pivot after San Bernardino. Terrorism and labor migration became one thing.
And what that tells you is that it's not specific immigrants. It's not even necessarily immigration itself. But this becomes the vehicle to touch people's anxieties about a whole bunch of other matters.
This year, immigration became all wrapped up in people's anxieties about jobs, terrorism, and the failure of government to perform basic functions like policing the border. Exacerbating all these anxiety-producing factors is a gridlocked political system that can't seem to solve big problems no matter which party has control. And here, Republicans are angry at their own party's leaders in Washington in a way Democrats just aren't, says conservative analyst Henry Olson, author of The Four Faces of the Republican Party.
And they've been listening to politicians who have been telling them for decades now that government can and ought to shrink quickly. And they think that when Republicans are elected, that that's what Republicans got elected on. So they are angry for things that they've been told they can have, but most people in politics know they really can't.
Voters in both parties are angry at elites. But just like everything else this year, Democratic and Republican populists are pointing their pitchforks at two very different targets. Again, Bill Galston.
For the Republicans, the anti-elite focus is on government and professional experts of all kinds. And for the Democrats, and especially the more left-leaning Democrats, the focus is on economic and financial elites.
And it's not clear, says Galston, which candidates will benefit most from all that angry anti-elitism when voters finally start going to the polls next month.
Elections serve a number of very important functions, and one of them is to hold up a mirror to society. We learn something about who we are and what we're feeling and what we want through the electoral process. And a lot of things that are beneath the surface come to the surface during the intensity of electoral combat.
And those feelings are defining the 2016 elections. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
Joining me in the studio is Terry Jones, the founder's professor of political science and public policy administration at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Terry, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
What do you make of that report and the content?
I think it's right on. I think we are seeing in the 2016 election a lot of things that have been developing over the past several decades come home and be very prominent. There's a generation of whites, primarily high school education or less, who have not participated in the economic growth of the last 30 years, and they are not pleased. There's pessimism. There's the notion that people thought that every generation would have a better go at it. That's no longer the case. There is a lot of anger in our society.
Is that something you're telling us as an academic, or is it something that you're hearing from your friends and colleagues and compatriots?
As an academic, because we pretty are classified in our own little worlds. And so this both primarily is data, but also focus groups and public opinion polls that I've conducted.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems to be out there, no question about it. We want to take the pulse of our listening audience. So I'll say that if you want to tell us what your mood is and why, we'd love to hear from you. 382-8255, that's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or we'll take a tweet at STL on air. While Mara was doing her report there, we already had an email from Stephen who writes, "I'm in throw all the rascals out mood. Both political parties, both spectrums are failing us. It's time to start over with a clean set of legislators at all levels, federal, state, county, and local." I think Stephen's speaking for a lot of people.
Yes, and on the other hand, we still return, if you want to call them rascals, a lot of our elected officials with high reelection rates for incumbents. So we all don't always act on what we say.
And the politicians seem very, very adroit at tapping into this time around.
You can look at elections as marketing experiments, with the candidates being the product that is being marketed. And certainly the success that Donald Trump has, unexpected success, and how Bernie Sanders doing well, better than and people anticipated, is both being indicators that marketing anger and having an enemy works.
Are you sensing that there's any one thing in this particular area where we are right now that perhaps has people most concerned? I mean, whether it's the economy or whether it's fear of terrorism, that sort of thing.
The growing realization that the American dream, each generation being better off than the one preceding it, and the disappointment of that fact, and then looking around and seeing an America that is no longer primarily white but is diverse and trying to adjust to that are both contributing to this factor.
Wearing your political scientist's hat, given where we are now in the campaign, and of course there are many months to go, would you anticipate that the chances are better for an outsider to prevail this time?
Normally I would have answered that question saying no. The Americans have always wanted an experienced individual in the White House. Every president in the 20th century has been a senator, a governor, or former vice president, with two exceptions, Herbert Hoover and Dwight Eisenhower, both of whom held major government positions and appointed positions. So Americans want competence, want experience, but this time doesn't seem that way.
You know, most people thought when Donald Trump got into the race several months ago, I guess back in June or thereabouts, that he would last maybe throughout the summer, but he gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Is he better at tapping into the public conscience, do you think?
He's been superb at it. And that quote that was on the report about he accepts the mantle of anger captured that.
But what he's doing also is any time anyone steps up to challenge him in any way or seems to be getting close to him in the polls, which he follows obviously very closely, he strikes them down. It's almost like he has a sword.
He has benefited from the fact that there's not a clear number two, and either on the establishment side or on the the so-called outsider element. So, but yes, he's been also adroit at making sure whenever somebody sticks his head above the polling mark, the threshold that he regards as serious, there he is to make a point or an attack on that individual.
All right. We're going to get some input from people in our listening area and listeners. Coming up first is Willis Johnson, who is the pastor of Wellspring Church in Ferguson. Pastor Johnson, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to get your take on what are you hearing from the people that you associate with regard to their mood and their concerns? Are they angry?
Well, obviously, there's a great deal of frustration in the local and national community around issues around economics and obviously just the political climate of our national leadership. And so, yes, people are probably in some ways angry, but mostly frustrated and seemingly desperate for any kind of change. And while that's probably a good thing that people desire change and some transformative work, the options seem to be very limited, and unfortunately, there seems to be a dumbing down of the electorate to the point where things don't have to be true; they can just be said often and be bombastic and outlandish. It's a lot easier to talk about stuff in grandiose and wide kind of perspective and term until you have to actually own up to it and do it. And so I think people want to see change. Obviously, they are a lot more interested in listening to a wider conversation, but I don't know if that wider conversation has gotten deeper yet. And that's what I continue personally, as well as others around me, are waiting to hear.
You know, you used the word frustration early on in your comment, and one of the things I wanted to get to specifically deals with the situation in Ferguson, where you are. You know, it's been my observation that there has not been much discussion during this national political campaign about many of the issues that emerged in Ferguson. Are you hearing, is that the frustration that you're hearing people say, why haven't they been listening to us for the last year and a half?
Well, of course. I mean, obviously, not only why they've not been listening to us the last year and a half, but why they have not been listening to communities, urban communities like Ferguson and elsewhere around the country. Unfortunately, we're a community that is small in scale, and it's right now it's about who's going to vote in the immediate future, who's having caucuses. And so we understand, I think people should understand why this is somewhat gotten on the back burner. But I think more importantly, this issue is not going to be raised. The concerns of urban municipalities like Ferguson and others across the country have not been priority for the larger political machine for a long time. And more importantly, people are not going to raise this issue, especially candidates at this time, because truth be told, no one really has a solution, nor are they willing to create or commit to the resources and the effort and the energy that's going to be necessary to really adequately and effectually make some changes and create equity and opportunity where there is none.
Is this frustration going to lead people to vote or maybe sit this one out?
Well, I think you definitely see a lot of energy of our young people, and particularly those of some of the recent movements who are very much engaged, raising consciousness, question, engaging in some critical both reflection and conversation. Obviously, that has shown itself probably in support of a small number of candidates, mostly Democratic. But I'm believing and I'm optimistic that there's going to be a greater turnout or show of force. I just think people are very despondent right now across the spectrum that whoever gets in or whoever is espousing their plans and wants now, they're wondering if they really won will hold true to them. Will they be not only honorable to their word and to their vision, but is there really the ability, the skill set, the relationship, and the want in Congress, and then it's way down across the states, even into municipal governments, for people to actually do what is just, loving, equitable, and right among its citizens. That's the real concern. That's the real frustration. That's the real angst that I hear from parishioners that I hold personally as not only a leader but a citizen in my community and in this national scope. And I think that's really what we all need to be answering the question, not who can dream the biggest, but who is going to be most effective in getting the job done to the benefit of the whole electorate.
Well, we shall see. Willis Johnson, I want to thank you so much for spending a couple of moments with us. I know you're in a meeting and interrupted that to be with us. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, appreciate you, Brother Marsh. That's have a great day.
Willis Johnson, pastor of the Wellspring Church in Ferguson. With me in studio is Terry Jones, a political scientist and public policy professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We have to take a break. Terry, I want to come back and respond, get your response to something that Pastor Johnson said. We'll do that in a moment. We'll take calls as well at 382-8255. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation about voter mood. Terry Jones, professor at University of Missouri, St. Louis, is with me in studio. Terry, Pastor Johnson said something that kind of struck me, and that is he talked about young people and the energy they've had in Ferguson throughout the last year and a half. I wonder if you have any sense of the potential. Maybe that's not the right word, but I'm thinking about young voter involvement in this election cycle, whether this kind of rhetoric is enough to encourage them to vote or maybe cause them to sit out.
The jury is still out on that. Certainly overall, more people are paying attention to the 2016 elections than did so in 2012 or 2008. So that's a harbinger of an increased turnout. That also is the case for people 18 to 29, but not dramatically more than people older than that. And one of the first tests we'll have of that is in Iowa, because so much of Bernie Sanders' support in that state is from people that are under 35, and whether or not they'll turn out on a cold Monday night, next Monday night, to participate in the Iowa caucuses will be one test of youth involvement in the 2016 process.
I heard a pundit on television the other day say, if they can't vote on the internet, they're probably not going to vote. Now, well, I don't think he was being totally facetious. Yeah.
That's a nice quip, but that they also show up at other places in person, so yeah. That can be a precinct caucus in Iowa as well.
You mentioned Sanders. Let's bring in Tom. He's calling us from Afton. I think he has Bernie Sanders on his mind. Go ahead, Tom.
Thanks, Don. I'm a college-educated progressive and sort of an activist, so it's not a surprise that I'm a Bernie supporter, but I've been very surprised to encounter people, you know, both online and at events, who I met one guy who said he wasn't sure whether he was going to vote for Trump or Sanders. Those were his choices. And people online who are like 60-year-old working-class white males that are behind Sanders. So it's not just the usual suspects, it looks like. And I wonder if that's showing up in the polling, or, you know, the people who track this stuff are aware of that, because what we hear is that the white working class likes Trump.
It's better to conceptualize public opinion not on a left-right line that is straight, but rather that curves back on itself. So when times are bad and perceived as bad, you have forces on the right and on the left sometimes, if not coalescing, sharing opinions, saying, let's get something new in here.
Tom, thank you so much for the call. We've asked our listening audience through our website to give us their take on and what they're feeling and what their mood is during this election cycle. And we have a short clip here that will give us some indication of how people are responding to this cycle.
I am Barbara K. Anderson, and I live in Southwest City. Donald Trump scares the heck out of me. If people are going with their gut in anger about everything, and we all have a lot of reason to be angry. His anger is, I share a lot of things that he says, but I want to know what his substance is. What are you going to do beyond calling people names and bullying people?
Michael Corey, North City. Both Clinton and Sanders have made hatred their mainstay. You know, it may not be hatred towards a creed or color, but it's hatred towards an entire class of people. And they're doing their best to, you know, trump up that hatred. Trump, at the same time, has made his stand as the maverick outsider. And in this case, the maverick outsider means completely unqualified and knows nothing about the job for which he's applying. The inmates are running the show at this point, and the fact that these three have just dominated the media presence is just so worrying.
Lee Lyons, and I'm from University City, Missouri. I guess I feel a little angry at the political process, mainly because it appears very little is being done. A lot of talk, a lot of accusations, a lot of finger pointing, but there seems to be very little accomplished.
My name is Kenneth Newhouse. I live in Ellisville, Missouri. I would say bleh or meh. I'm really not interested in the political process right now. So I'd say boring. I'm bored with the political process right now. I'm a staunch Republican and conservative. I lean libertarian on a lot of issues, but I'm just very tired of the negativity within my party among all the candidates. They're all bashing each other. They all say America's going straight to heck.
I'm a Spurush. I'm here in St. Louis. So I'm not very optimistic, but as a person, I'm really hopeful that things will work out well in the end. And until now, it has just not even a single vote has been casted, even in the primary. So it's okay. So you always had, at some point or the other, one of the extreme candidates being leading in the poll. So I'm not so nervous about it, but I just hope. I mean, I'm not sure whether today in 2016 the situation is that those extremes may get the number one position no matter what. I don't know. I don't think so. I hope so. I hope not.
The St. Louis Public Radio listeners came to us through our Public Insight Network. That montage of commentary from was put together by producer Kelly Moffitt. You know, Terry Jones, and listening to that, I can understand why people are angry and frustrated and anxious. Boring this election cycle has not been, I don't think.
No, it's unusual to hear that reaction.
Yeah. We have another person that we're going to call upon now to get their take on all of this that we've been talking about, the public mood, this election cycle. Laura Granish is director of the St. Louis Office of Missouri Jobs with Justice. She's joining us from Kansas City. Laura, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
What's your take on the mood as you see it with regard to this election cycle?
Well, I think the anxieties you've been hearing throughout the program today are something we hear as well, and we hear about it a lot as people think about the economic security of their families. Really, for so many families in the region and in the state, the wages are declining while debt is rising, and compounding all that is the fact that work is increasingly insecure for so many people as contingent work grows and the on-demand economy sort of takes secure jobs into jobs that people don't even know if they're going to have them next year or next month.
Do you get the sense in the people you talk with that they feel that anybody who's out there running is addressing this issue well enough that they would vote for them or that they could solve the problem?
I think people are definitely sizing candidates up on this basis. I mean, issues like whether you support increasing the minimum wage, issues like whether you support unions that lift up not only union members, but help support a floor and leverage for all workers in the economy. These are the sort of issues that people are looking at candidates and saying, this tells us which side you're on.
I guess it's going to come down to actually how many people get out there and vote or whether they're going to be so turned off or so disenchanted that they might not bother. Do you have any sense of that at this stage of the campaign?
It is early for that, but I will tell you one of the very alarming dynamics that I know we need to really work hard against is the idea that a vote doesn't matter as much as a donation, that voters don't matter as much to these candidates as their donors do. And that is a really toxic sentiment in our democracy. We really need to be working hard to make sure it's true and that voters can believe in the idea that their vote matters as much as the influence of a lobbyist or a donor.
Well, Laura, thank you for being with us. I want to ask Terry Jones to respond to that part of it, that the dollars for the campaign are more important. But let me just say goodbye to Laura first, and thank you once again for being with us.
Thank you.
That you always need dollars in order to have a campaign. You also need people. Indeed, that's one of the real tests that we have coming up in Iowa, because Trump has been able to get earned media, a lot of attention. He has some money of his own and others that he's collected. What he has not demonstrated to date, whether he has the people to work on the ground to get the vote out. But you can't run a campaign solely through media. You need campaign organization. You need passionate volunteers.
Do you think Iowa is more meaningful this time than it has been in the past? I mean, we've had plenty of presidents who have won the presidency without winning Iowa.
No, it is not, although Iowa really treasures its place in the process. And well over half of the coverage in January is about Iowa and Des Moines and what life is like there. It's always played an important role, and this is still another example of that.
Let's take a couple more calls. I'll bring in Gloria, who is calling from Creve Coeur. Gloria, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You had a guest before who mentioned that the issues that have concerned us about Ferguson and Baltimore and other inner cities don't seem to be on the campaign agenda and being discussed right now. And my comment is the reason for that is because we have a primary system that focuses all of its attention early on Iowa and New Hampshire, neither of which have a major city, both of which are predominantly white. So there's no question that these issues are not going to come up in this kind of a, even though these issues concern hundreds of thousands of people and are more representative of the discussion that should be taking place, they're not on the agenda because of the way we schedule our primary system. I'd like to hear your comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gloria.
It's a very good point. And we need also to keep in mind that not all that many delegates are actually at stake in Iowa and New Hampshire. The real prizes come along in March and April, where particularly when you have winner-take-all contests in states like Ohio and Florida. So I think you're going to be seeing more talk, more discussion about urban issues as the campaign moves to those sites.
And North Carolina, I think, is coming up after New Hampshire.
South Carolina.
South Carolina, I beg your pardon. And it'll certainly come up there, I would think.
Again, not so much. I think we're talking about a March and April phenomenon where large city issues will be at the forefront of campaign rhetoric.
Let's take another call, and we'll bring in Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I think a lot of people are just noticing these trends that have been going on for decades. You know, 50 years ago, American corporations needed American consumers, and so they didn't mind, or at least part of the plan was to make sure people had enough income. And I think what corporations want today are essentially insecure, powerless workers, kind of the Southern model that we see. And the other point is that Ronald Reagan was excellent at doing this decades ago. I mean, part of his stump speech was he would always say something along the lines of, just who do they think they are? And it was always a big applause line, never once bringing up any specific about what was being addressed or who the they were. And yet people felt some sense of it's like a free-floating anger that he was able to channel very, very well without being specific about anything.
Thanks,
so
Jerry.
It's kind of a rerun of that to me, but thank you.
I would contrast Ronald Reagan's more grandfatherly, let's all be friends approach with the more sharp, bombastic nature of a Donald Trump, or for that matter, a Bernie Sanders.
Take another call. Mike joins us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Don, and hi, Terry. We keep throwing mud at each other and blaming the other guy. The corporations blame the workers and vice versa. And it really comes down to lack of integrity. And that works its way from the fundamental lack of integrity of our money. No one really knows what the value of the dollar is, but the managers, the central banks, they manage the money in preference to the corporations. And no one minds that as long as everything's going well. But in 2007, when that game started to fall apart, we're now just picking its trial, trying to figure out how this happened, that we don't make any money, and yet the stock market careened up to, you know, 18,000 for the big guys. So I think its integrity is the core problem, and I don't know how we're going to fix it unless we all can understand that we can measure a gallon of milk, we can measure a foot, and imagine what the world would look like if those things were not standard.
There's been a sharp drop in trust and confidence in many of our institutions, including the media, including Wall Street, and that makes it even more difficult for us to govern ourselves.
We had a number of responses through email and Facebook to our query as to what the local mood was this election year. Just I'll give you a few of the responses. Kara Case says she is sickened by it. Cheryl Blake says she is wary of the entire political process right now. Bob Kenny says he is angry. Ivan Martin says he is amazed at how the news media's pursuit of profit and ratings have covered the pseudo-fascist sideshow of Donald Trump at the expense of other more viable candidates. I wanted to get to the media's role in this because obviously it's prominent.
One statistic that I found very interesting is that roughly 70% of the coverage of the Republican candidates between the late summer and early January was about Donald Trump. So his ability to get the media to pay a lot of attention to him has been extraordinarily impressive. Oscar Wilde once said that it's one thing worse than being talked about, it's not being talked about. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump knows how to be talked about.
Well, he certainly has. I've been astounded at the number of networks who will interrupt the cable, I have to specify cable networks, who will interrupt their programming to live to a Trump speech. They're not doing that with anybody else.
And they continue to do it.
Yeah.
So you and I both know he slept in a Holiday Inn Express within the last few days.
Right. Well, that, when the writer writes about the entertainment value of this campaign, they're really onto something, aren't they?
They definitely are.
Let's take one more call from Kate in Florissant. Speaking of Trump, that'll be it once we hear from Kate. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I sometimes think that to make a first step towards improvement, you have to hit rock bottom. And bearing that in mind, electing Trump would be hitting rock bottom. But it may be the thing that saves us. You have him as president. What do you do? All of a sudden, all the theatrics and the media hype and everything else will be washed away, and we'll be left with a man incapable of ruling this country in any way. Congress will have to work together, if only to control him. And it may be the best thing that could happen.
Thank you, Kate, for the call, Terry.
We have a making of a science fiction story, a novel. Let's see how it plays out.
Of course, we'd have him for 4 years if he were elected. I hear an awful lot of people talking that way. This Trump guy is just really amazing at what he's been able to do.
He's astounded both political scientists, journalists, and other observers.
And what do we have? It's almost the second month. We've got 9 months to go.
Right.
Terry Jones, thanks so much for being with us. Always great talking to you. And it's very interesting getting some sense of what our local audience is thinking with regard to this. And we'll be hearing more.
Very insightful.
Yeah, very much so. Thank you, Terry Jones.
Thank
once
you.
Again. Coming up, the changing face of graffiti art. That's right, I said art. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.